And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we are on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Dorian Karchner. Dorian is an agent at Lowenstein Yost Associates in New York, established in 1975. He earned an MFA from the University of Iowa and specializes in launching new voices in literary and mainstream fiction and narrative nonfiction. Her clients include Jennifer Hay, author of the Penn Hemingway-winning national bestseller Mrs. Kimball, Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Robert Rosenberg, who's gripping a vicious epic, This Is Not Civilization, is Hilton Mifflin's lead debut fiction title for spring, and Amy Fon, a 25-year-old Vietnamese-American author, whose forthcoming collection, We Should Never Meet, Robert Owen Butler calls a thrillingly important book. And we had one of Dorian's clients on a month or so ago, Diana Wagman, who was on talking about Hi, Dorian.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. I've just heard so much about you from clients that just think so highly of you, or from people who would like to be your clients. So,
flattery will always go far. Thank you very much.
Will you talk about how you became an agent? What drew you in?
I'm from a very entrepreneurial family. My father very much a self-made man, and I grew up watching him start small businesses and struggle in business. I was also always very, very involved with writing and reading. And after college, I went to work for my father when he was launching a record label. And pretty soon thereafter, I decided that the world of writing was really where my heart was. And I went and I did an MFA in Iowa. And sometime while I was there, I really realized that there would be a way to meld my entrepreneurial business background and my love of writing and my love of talking about writing and editing. And it really was like a light bulb went off. And I realized that agency could really thought, gosh, I think I might be really good at doing this. And I came back to New York. I grew up here. I came back after finishing my MFA. And set out trying to find a position at an agency. My lowest CEO's retiring, and we just quit. And I started very aggressively trying to build a list from pretty much the second week I started working there.
So do you handle mostly fiction, or are you kind of across the board? Do you handle nonfiction?
I handle nonfiction as well. I would say my list is probably 60-65% fiction. The rest is nonfiction. Most of my nonfiction is narrative, so always telling a story. The truth of the matter is, it doesn't much matter to me if the story is true or fiction, as long as it's a terrific story there in a voice that can really carry it. So I'm very interested in both, but somehow my list has ended up being a little bit heavier on the fiction side, I think.
You just mentioned that word, that writers, that puzzle writers a lot, especially beginning writers, and that is voice. Do you hear that when a writer first queries you, whether they're a novelist or whether they're writing nonfiction? Do you hear them query whether and do you expect them?
That's a great question. I expect you, but not too much. It's a very fine line, and I haven't thought of it exactly in the way you put it, and I think that's a very useful way of thinking about it. The short answer is yes, I do want to hear a voice from it, but I don't want a kind of jumping off the deep end, wild and crazy. I don't expect the letter to have the same voice or nearly as big of a voice as perhaps the manuscript would. But at the same time, I do expect to see in the letter something that differentiates it a little bit. I certainly expect to see a little hint of the writing itself that might actually come across in the manuscript. That said, I always prefer an
just deploy, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that you really don't expect to get anymore, regardless of genre or other.
I have my specific little ways that I want to get things in an ideal world, but mm-hmm. most people don't know what those ways are and can't know unless they visit my website and look at my agent profile where I do specify how I want to receive them.
Yeah.
There's never an expectation in speaking in general terms. A straightforward query letter with a stamped self-addressed envelope is always a good website.
So then you get the query, and so now let's just talk about fixing. You get the query, and there's something in the letter, either that you hear the voice, you like the idea, there's something that's compelling. What happens next?
What happens next is I request to see material. Sometimes I'm, for whatever reason, a combination of reasons, as you say, a combination of the way the product is articulated in the letter and the potential client credentials or publishing history. For whatever reason, I'm very excited. Sometimes I'll just pick up the phone and make the call and say, this sounds really interesting. Please send me the first 50 to 75 pages. Sometimes I'll just drop an email. So I request material, usually not an entire manuscript. Sometimes it's daunting to have the piles are going all the way. So sometimes I generally like to start with just a sample, but always from the beginning. It doesn't work for me, or I think for most agents, to get an excerpt from somewhere in the middle. One really needs to see, especially with fiction, how the book opens and how the writer goes about getting the yarn through a couple of consecutive chapters.
So, writers actually send you something from the middle of the book and say something like, this is where it really gets good?
That has been known to happen. It's not effective.
Yeah.
Yeah. People, that certainly happens many times. In fact, they mainly were talking about things that I get that come in on request over the transom. Very often, people will include chapter 8. I love this chapter. This is a really very interesting moment. I thought I would include the climactic moment, and obviously that's not going to be effective.
Yeah. How far do you need to read? Can you know from the first line, the first paragraph, the first page, whether it's something that works for you or not? And you have to read on to really get a sense of the material.
I can get extremely excited from the first paragraph. It doesn't mean, of course, that I'm going to make a decision to sign it up in a minute, but I can certainly get excited enough that I'm going to put everything else aside and just sit with that manuscript and read. And if my heart keeps pounding, the way it starts to pound with excitement in that first paragraph, and if it's still pounding that way on page 10, then I'll pick up that phone. I get the phone numbers on the manuscript, but I'll drop an email. And I'll really try to get myself a little bit of time to review the material exclusively. Of course, it's a promise that I'll look at it very quickly, and then I'm quite serious about it.
Yes.
But yes, I can often tell, not always by a long shot, but there are certainly times where I can tell right away that I'm just something by a voice, by a feel, by a sense of the planet, even. But it's really about the voice, ultimately, once you start reading.
And is it different, whether it's literary fiction or mainstream fiction, or the voice has to be there, strong, you know what I mean?
I think voice has to be there strong no matter what, but I think that it's important to define voice fairly broadly. I think that it's very easy to think of voice as being this one thing, this look at me, the musical equivalent of a big, belting song, that it has to be so stunning in some way. And that's not the case. Voice can be subtle and very refined. It doesn't have to be pyrotechnic. It doesn't have to be wildly humorous. There's so many different manifestations of voice. I think that really what voice is, and I haven't thought about it exactly this way before, but it is a writer who has written enough to have developed, to have gotten to the heart of the way he or she speaks. It's almost like a fingerprint. And I think it can take It's not just that these are arbitrary distinctions, and it's not just that they're distinctions that I think the publishing houses put on material in order to market that distinction about market versus mainstream. But I would say that with certain genre fiction, for example, mysteries and thrillers and romances, we're talking much more about certain kinds of strong characterizations and very, very strongly plot-driven material. And while literary fiction, and I can't stress this enough, this has become very important to me, that I believe that literary fiction, no matter how literary, still needs an extremely strong sense of structure and plotting. I would say voice is the most important element. Single most important element. You can get away with thin plotting if you have enough of a voice. The voice can carry additional plotting.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Dorian Crossmore, literary agent from New York. It is interesting because when I read a mystery, I'm not looking for the same things as I'm hoping for in a literary novel. In a mystery, certain mysteries, it seems to be pretty much written by anybody because it's the story and the plot that's carrying you along, and not that I need to segue traffic to those types of stories, but a literary novel or a literary short story, the plot can be so thin. If the characters and the voice and the writing are just there.
I think, too, though, this is maybe personal, but it could also stand to define plot a little bit more broadly, because I would assert that in probably all most literary fiction, there is plot, but it's not necessarily external events acting in a written dramatic way, the way that a mystery is, or romance is, or fiction, for example. But there's still a momentum, there's still an internal tension, there's still unfolding and shifting of emotion, and that can be truly psychological, but it's still a plot.
Yeah.
And maybe take a Gregorian novel, for example, any novel, really, where the driving force is the unreliable narrator, and the story, the heart of the story, of course, is in the narrator coming to understand something about him or herself, or in the reader understanding the narrator beyond what the narrator can understand. And that's very, very subtle on a quantum level. And yet, of course, it's still, as I said before, there's still a sense of mystery and unfolding and momentum. And that's what I consider plot.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because, thinking of some blockbuster novels where the plot is very external, and maybe in the best of, say, blockbusters, there is also an internal thing going on, but it is external. And I think literary writers, especially new literary writers, tend to become really confused as to exactly how much they need to play. It becomes a real confusion, especially if they pick up a magazine like Writer's Digest, but, it's very much, very commercial.
Right.
Interesting. What about, you mentioned Chicklet.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of going away, or is it as strong as ever? People are different things.
Just a sentence in the rain somewhere. I think a lot of people in the industry expect that it's a fad, and expect in a kind of abstract way that it's splitting out, and isn't everybody sick of it yet? But the numbers belie that, and that's kind of interesting. The numbers on Chicklet remain very strong, as far as I know. Now, I think that readers are becoming more discriminating, which I think is good. I think that the genre is becoming more diverse. I think one thing could happen in many genres, that the genre starts out being one thing, and then the reader demands newer expressions based on it, and then you end up with, maybe you end up with Southern Chicklet, or maybe you end up with, or maybe you end up with Chicklet mysteries, or you end up with some kind of hybrid that becomes interesting. hybrids that are emerging and that are keeping the genre going at real quick.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I know other people, I know authors who consider their work cichlid, but I would never consider cichlid in terms of how I think it's defined. I mean, authors that tend to be somewhat literary but more mainstream, and they want to be thought of as cichlid. And I find that interesting. I don't know if it's because it seems marketable or less marketable. Or,
I think it's a marketing hook. It's interesting to me that you say that, because I see the inverse probably a little bit more. What I see publishers packaging and marketing books as cichlid that maybe aren't, that would go above and beyond. And I think there are a lot of books that are unfairly lumped into a category of cichlid. And I think just as there are a lot of books that are lumped into some category called women's fiction, I think that it's used as a slightly derogatory term, or lowbrow, or has lowbrow implications that doesn't necessarily deserve. So I'm not sure that I would say that a girl back to something in fiction is cichlid in the same way that E.J. Nate is cichlid.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they're both nowadays called that. And I think that maybe there's a hint of sexism in that, just because I think there's more than a hint of sexism in the term women fiction.
Excellent. Well, what about the idea of maybe fact that women buy most of the fiction? Women buy most books. I guess that's what I hear a lot. So should women be thinking of that when they're writing? Should people in general, writers in general, just keep the marketplace out of mind? I mean, how much, it's like we hear publishing is harder than ever, and, selling fiction is harder than ever, and all that. It sort of messes with writers' minds.
Yes, it really does. I think MFA programs make the very mind too, and that's something we should talk about. A hard question. I think really when push comes to shove, one cannot write with the marketplace in mind when one is writing a market plus literary fiction. I think that's very, very different from not writing with an audience. The reader in mind. I think one must write with the reader in mind. But that reader, by the reader, I'm not talking about the buyer. I'm not talking about an editor. I'm not talking about an agent. I'm not talking about the person who's been paying $25 for it. So I'm talking about the marketplace. I'm talking about your reader. You're communicating something to somebody. Why? What is it you need to communicate? You're not just communicating to yourself. You're attempting to communicate with another person. And so I think that that's really what, at various points in the process, literary writers, maybe need to bear in mind a little bit more than some young writers do. But I do not believe in writing to the marketplace when it comes to authentic fiction. I think that would probably kill originality, freshness, the potential of finding one's voice, and imagination more than anything else. But it must have. And you haven't hit the commercial popularity that she between writing a short story collection and writing an album,
mm-hmm.
you might want to go for the novel.
Yeah. Short stories have the same.
Yes, very difficult.
Yeah. I think the writers when they're working on short stories don't realize that, at least what I've heard from agents, they really need major publications with these. I mean, the Manitoba Review is not going to do it. They have to be in the New Yorker and so much stuff.
I think there's something going on. There has to be a little bit of an event surrounding the series. In other words, there has to be some industry buzz. It's very hard because, and I'm not saying people shouldn't write stories. I think that obviously this is how one develops some trust for so many writers on the story. That's important. It's just simply what one's expectations are for those stories. I was at the University of Iowa a few weeks ago talking to the students in the writer's workshop, and I was saying to them, you know, maybe you've got to change what your expectations are for your story. Maybe you graduate from this program with 10 terrific stories that are terrific enough to get you an agent who's waiting for you to finish that novel.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they're terrific enough for you to get, you know, 5, 6, 7 great cards from the Lit Mag, which agents would like to see in the query letters. You know, maybe it's not about actually getting a book note and launching a career with these stories. And more, there's a very compelling case to be made that even if one can sell one story collection and start one's career off with the publication of a collection, that may not actually be the wisest way to launch a new career. I've made a number of two-book deals with novels and collections, novels that are maybe 75 pages written. And the editor sort of begrudgingly takes the collection as well and says, you know what, we're going to wait for novels to finish and we're going to publish the novel first. So more and more, I think and there are exceptions, and of course, we all pay a lot of attention to the exceptions, but maybe too much attention is paid to them, and that the standard really needs to be, and it's more and more. The reality is that launching with a terrific novel is a very, very wise move.
I'd like to talk more than that. Excuse me, when we come back, stay tuned, all of you out there. We'll be back with Julie and Tashma right after this. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Yeah.
University of California, Irvine campus. We are on the web as well at kbcr.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have been here since 5 with literary agent Dorian Cockmore from the Weinstein Youth Associates in New York. Hey, Dan.
Hi.
Let me also say before we go on that the opinions and views that you hear on this paradox of New York are not those of the University of California Regents. Goodness, Dan. Anyway.
Stop with this.
Before we went to break, Dorian, you said something to the effect of that a good story collection may not be the wisest way to learn a literary career. Could you say more about that?
Yes. Whether we like it or not, a reality, which is that the business is a business, and the buyers pay a lot of attention to book reviews and to other forms of marketing. There are real quandaries about, in general, how to get attention for works of fiction in the marketplace. There are a number of ways of promoting a media outlet for promoting nonfiction, the talk shows, the radio show. There are many fewer outlets for the promotion of fiction. And there are many thousands of books published every year. So publishers are really concerned with the question, how are we going to promote this? How are we going to get people to pay attention to this new title? Those issues are there with any work of fiction. Those issues are compounded when it comes to the short story. It is exceedingly difficult to market a short story collection. That's why we see more and more collections that are very strongly lived collections. You hear the term man novel and story. You hear a big story. More than ever, publishers are demanding really that story collections be cohesive in some way, and that a little bit more marketable, so you're a little bit more of a marketing hook. In addition, as much as people love to write short stories, and as much as many people love to read them, not nearly as many people love to read them as love to read novels, and not nearly as many people are willing to spend $24, $25 on a story collection as they are on a new novel. So one runs up against the market reality that it's very difficult to get out good, solid numbers on a story collection. Almost regardless of how much review coverage you get, I mean, it's very tough out there. People read the review. Maybe they read one of the stories, you know, in Internet Mag or in one of the national magazines. But they simply don't there's not the sense of the value of their money. They go out, it's a hardcover book, it costs $23, $24, $25, and they're getting some short stories by an unknown writer. So how are you going to get a buyer to take that risk? And that's really the question. So one thing one does see more and more of are trade paperback original short story collections. And that can be a nice solution because those are priced much more reasonably. So people are more willing to take a risk on a new voice and on stories if they're priced more modestly. That is one way around the some publishers are finding around this issue.
Interesting. Given speaking, you know, we hear so much about shorter attention spans, and so you would think that maybe there would be more interest in a short story to give a better short attention span.
That's a good point, and I'm not sure how that's going to translate. I think that what we see is a short novel. Small novels. You know, Girl in High Instance Moon, Girl with a Pearl Earring. The Mark Haddon novel is short. We talked about that before. I think we are seeing thin novels, airplane reads, in some cases, as well, commercial fiction. It's interesting what you say, but it hasn't not translated into people selling at $25 a
piece. Yeah.
Although I wish it did.
Yeah. Let's talk about nonfiction just a little too, in terms of, again, it begins with the query life, and queries you, and talks about their project and then what?
Then I ask to see a proposal. Now, good men, is a little bit different from broader everyday self-help cartoon. But in general, whereas fiction is told on the basis of a complete manuscript for the most part, nonfiction is often not. Nonfiction is often told on the basis of a book proposal. And a book proposal takes a real marketing approach towards its material. It's comprised of a number of different sections, which I won't go into detail here. But the reason with nonfiction, if someone clears me on that, I love it if I have a proposal actually ready. Because if I read a query and I think it's a terrific idea, I want to move on it quickly. I want to actually be able to see something. And since most nonfiction is sold on the basis of the proposal, I don't actually want the whole manuscript. I want the book proposal. So usually I will, I'll request the proposal. I will read it quickly, and we go from there. In the case of memory, for example, which is treated much more like, it's sold much more along the lines of fiction. For memoir, I would expect to see a very large
What about memoir? Is that another one of those areas that is saturated, that we hear anyway, that it's saturated? Or no, a good memoir is always a market for a good memoir, where there's something happening.
I think there's very much a market, actually, for personal stories told in the service of something larger. I think that the great memoir, the very interior, very personal story, the abuse story, the addiction story, I think that those have largely run their course. But I think that what we're seeing are some very interesting stories where the writer combines memoir with something else. So, for example, I recently sold a terrific project called The Stargazing Year, which is the personal story of a man who, ever since he was a child, was obsessed with astronomy. And this is the story of the year he spent building an observatory in his backyard. And it is both this very personal way into the science of astronomy, and it's a great introduction for people to the night sky. So that's one example of a sort of hybrid. I think that personal stories that are compellingly told, that unfold much in the way the novel unfolds, but that also gives the reader a glimpse into another world, whatever that may be, whether it's science or art, as we go down Kitchen Confidential, whatever it may be, that somehow there's some area of expertise being brought to it. That, I think, really can work.
Can you talk about why a novel needs to be completed to sell, and why, say, with narrative nonfiction, it can sell on the basis of a book proposal, with just a few chapters and other information?
Largely because of what I mentioned earlier, which is the way these books are marketed. With book novels, there is often one big concern that a writer can start out with a bang. We're talking about literary novels. They can start out with a bang, but not be able to pull it off. Right? Then you can see the first, one can see the first 50 pages, and they're terrific, and then there's some serious second act dragging. And a real problem that emerges, because writing a novel is an exceedingly difficult thing to do, and pacing is a big part of that. And pacing and structure are very often the toughest stumbling block for first-time novelists to overcome. So there is, understandably, editors and houses, which is corporations, are looking to minimize their risk. They're spending a lot of money. It's not just the money on the advances. That's just the tip of the iceberg. They're spending a lot of money on each and every book. And why buy it on 75 pages if person's never proven they can do this before, and they can wait and see the whole thing and see if this person really can pull it off. So that's sort of the mindset often with fiction, but I think it's legitimate. have editors and therapists see that the author has the topic to get a great credential, above and beyond everything, a terrific platform by which I mean a way of promoting the book, a way of getting media attention for the book. They are, and then they see a writing therapist so that indeed the person can write. Then if there's an overview and an outline, I think that the risk is really minimized. And that's the blueprint of the challenge is to writing many different kinds of nonfiction are different from the challenges of writing a novel. And I think that proposals versus entire manuscripts reflect that difference. Now, as I said, it is different with memoir. Very narrative nonfiction memoir is sold much more than fiction is sold. Generally, evidence you want to see the whole manuscript, or at least that's the majority of it.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am talking with Dorian Kaufman, who is with Lowenstein Yost Associates in New York. Dorian, do you want to talk about how to get a hold of you, the website?
Our website is www.lowensteinyost.com, all one word. It's LOWENSTEIN, and each agent of the agency has a separate agent page there, so one can just click on my name and they'll be directly connected to me. I'd like to, if you snail mail me, which is more than fine, I'd like to see a concise cover letter. I'd love to see the first chapter of your project, if you're talking about fiction, I'd love to get a sense of the writing itself, and the inevitable sense of the conflict.
Yes. What if someone doesn't include it and says, you know, if you like it, I'll hear from you. If you don't like it, cross it, that's okay.
Oh, that's okay as long as the email address is on it.
Okay.
Yeah. But that generally really depends on the conflict. It's most of the time what people do is they say, I don't need the manuscript back. You know, I don't need this sample of the manuscript back. Here's just the, you know, a number to the envelope. What what is autonomous data right? And let's dive into that question, because I think that the maybe one of the most common mistakes of firing writers is trying to find an agent too early in their career. And I think that the MFA program, this is the client, there is a tremendous amount of looking over one's shoulder and comparing oneself to what everybody else is doing. And I think that these are also just a lot of gossip. It's a problem to any kind of small circle like these programs are. And I think that writers, very often you have a 23, 24-year-old writing, they have tremendous natural talent. Maybe they've been writing since they were 14, maybe they haven't. But they certainly not haven't fully refined and discovered what it is they need to say, and they're not deeply confident in what it is they're currently working on. And yet all around them they see them, supposedly this person got $500,000 for the story collection, that person got, you know, the field, and they said to him, wow, I expect that you should be doing. I've got to get an agent. You know, why don't I have the field yet? Why isn't my story collection being published? What am I doing wrong? And I think that is very, very tough for anybody trying to be anything creative to handle. I think that the inner critic is tough enough without putting nothing on top of it. All the gossip and the discussions of commercial success that these programs often do for us. But I would say that most of the time that's not voiced upon the students by the program itself or by the professors. On the contrary, they tend to be very insular, you know, very focused on the work itself. But it's something that can just boil up out of the ego and insecurity of the students in the close contact all the time.
Mm-hmm. What about advances? How are advances determined for, say, a first novel or a first narrative, a first book of narrative nonfiction?
They're determined largely by what the market will bear. I think a good agent goes into the submission process with a rough figure, a section in mind, from past experience, having a sense of what projects like this are going to have. But remaining flexible is really the key, because if there's only one editor who is interested in acquiring the project, it becomes more difficult, obviously, to command a higher advance than if there are a number of very hungry clients buying to the project. But that said, I would say that really most experienced agents have a broad in mind, and that really just comes from experience of having a sense of in a reasonable case scenario what kind of numbers the actual book will do. There is, believe it or not, in ideally some sort of correlation between the advance and the numbers of books the publisher actually sets itself. So this is why when one goes out in the story question, for example, it's wonderful if, for whatever reason, a number of editors stand up for it and the advance ends up being quite generous, well, great. I think there's the agents who turn that down. But I think that generally, in submitting a story question, one needs to have a very realistic expectation as opposed to submitting a big novel. And the question of what constitutes a big novel is a whole other part of the discussion. The main thing is there are subtle distinctions within the genre of upmarket fiction and upmarket narrative nonfiction. There are subtle subcategories and distinctions within there. And as an agent, one can read something and say, you know, I see this as a big book, and you have an idea of why it's big, but all the components of how it could be marketed, how marketable the author is, and the topic, and you really I know that I shouldn't get less than X amount for this book.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other books that you just have to see the storm for X men, or to see the storm for 5 men guys. That's going to depend on finding that gap out that he's missing the way that I see it.
Mm.
It's a very definite thing, in case you couldn't say.
We have a few minutes left with Brian Plushmore, who is with Livingston Youth Associates for New York. What about auctions? What then drives a book to an auction? Is it an auction tend to be one of those things that is sort of, you know, you can't see it coming and then it's here kind of thing with a book? Or do agents typically have a feeling that this is a book that's going to auction?
I think there's an feeling for that. And I think that one strives as an agent to have some control as well. I mean, in other words, to say this is the way you see as the submission is developing, as the response to the submission is coming. You start to say, okay, I submitted this to 7 people, and immediately people are calling me back, and they're really excited, which is what I wanted. And I have kind of got feeling that a number of people are really going to want this. And in fact, let me now send this out to more than the 7 people that I've originally seen this. And since I already see that the response I'm getting is so excited so quickly, I'm gonna seriously consider setting up an auction for this. And, you know, so you try as an agent to keep out in the past and to decide for yourself how the sales process should unfold, as opposed letting the houses determine that for you. You really try to gauge the seat of submission is giving off and plan accordingly for how you're going to try to start that deal. So I think that, you know, flexibility is key because often you can go out with something and think, I really think this is going to be hot, I think it's going to go to auction. And for whatever reason, you just won't. You know, for whatever combination of reasons, it doesn't fit that way. And that doesn't mean that does not mean you're not going to find a tremendous home for it and be able to make a great deal. And then there are other times where you go out and you say, I think this is going to be an auction situation. This is a really hot property. It's got all the right makings. And you stick to your guns and you end up being right. So it's one style of deal making. But certainly you can't plan on being an auction for every single piece of it.
Hey, we're at the end of our time. We have another minute left, Dory, and I can't believe it. Do you have any advice for the writers listening?
Yeah, I do. My advice is work really, really hard. Be humble before the craft. Try as much as you can not to be peering over your shoulders at what everybody else is doing and what you think everybody else is getting or not getting. And make that novel, the novel you're working on, the very, very best incarnation of itself that you possibly can. Be true to the demands of the book itself. And take whatever time it you need to take to get it to that point. Don't try to get an agent and make a deal fast and have it happen 6 months after you start your novel. Just remember that it really is about the art.
Good words. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time, too.
Thank you.
Coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. That was Dorian Kaufman. She is with Lowenstein Youth Associates in New York City. And that's where she was speaking to us then. If you'd like to know more about Writers and Writing, you can go to my website at writersandwriting.com. And you can send me an email and tell me you want to be on the weekly email list. And put you on it for every week, and then you can be on the show before the show happens. And if you'd like to know more about KUCI and the KUCI.org website, you can go to Dorian's website, Lowenstein Youth, in New York. Sorry, Lowensteinyouth.com. I have it at home. If you didn't write it down for me, I told you what it was earlier. Email me. I'll give it to you. I want to leave you with a quote by Annie Dillard, who said, "A writer looking for subjects inquiring not after what he loves best, but after what he alone loves at all." Thank you for listening. the Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KDCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.